We began last time by reading a short passage from Luke chapter 10 about Mary and Martha, which is familiar to most Christians, I think. Beginning at verse 38, it says, "Now it happened as they went that he entered a village, a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, 'Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me.' And Jesus answered and said to her, 'Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen the good part, which will not be taken from her.'" Now, as we pointed out, Mary and Martha both were disciples of Jesus. They both loved Jesus. They both intended to please the Lord. They had different ideas of how that should look. Martha was the hostess, so of course, as a hostess, bringing people into her home, especially someone like Jesus and his disciples, she wanted to be very solicitous to make sure their drinks were filled, their food was well prepared, everything was going smoothly. Mary, the younger sister, we may get the impression she was a little irresponsible, at least Martha got that impression, that Mary was not really helping at all. In fact, she was sitting in the living room with the disciples and Jesus, listening to Jesus teach. Now, this was considered very inappropriate in those days, even for a woman to sit at the feet of a rabbi. It was considered that women were not capable of being profitably taught the law. The rabbis didn't teach women. They didn't take women disciples. But Jesus didn't mind. He had female disciples, and Mary apparently realized that. Martha thought it was inappropriate and thought that she could use some help in the kitchen, which her sister was not providing. And so, of course, she brought the complaint to Jesus and said, "Could you tell my sister to come help?" And Jesus indicated that the problem in this case was not Mary, but Martha. Now, not that Martha was doing anything wrong. She just wasn't doing what the Lord preferred for her to do. We sometimes assume we know what a Christian ought to do. And sometimes we don't consult the Lord first to find out if that's what he's interested in us doing. And he told Martha, he said, in this translation, he didn't use the term distracted. I've seen translations where Martha, you're distracted by many things. Mary has chosen the good part, which is apparently means to listen to Jesus, to get instructions from him before acting, rather than assuming we know what he wants done. And so he stood up for Mary, and Jesus stood up for Mary on another occasion much later. You might remember Mary broke a jar of perfume over his head just before he was arrested. And the disciples complained that that was a very foolish thing to do. But Mary was in touch with Jesus. She knew far better where Jesus was at. Jesus defended her and said she had anointed him for his burial, which was interesting because the disciples who'd been with him all the time didn't even know he was going to die. He told them, but they didn't hear him. It went in one ear and out the other. And so when his death came a few days later, it totally surprised the disciples, but Mary was attuned to what Jesus was saying. She listened. She knew what was going on more than even the disciples did. So Mary was actually in a position and had priorities that were what Jesus himself favored. Martha had other priorities, which were not bad priorities. They just weren't the ones that Jesus wanted her to be bustling about and being distracted about it so that she couldn't listen to what he had to say. Now, I'm not talking about the exact parallel to that situation. We're talking about different ways that people become distracted from Jesus. In this case, it's not so much a matter of, you know, we're not listening to Jesus because we're too busy, although that may indeed be the problem for many people at many times. I'm thinking of ways in which Christians kind of get their whole lives distracted from Jesus. They start out zealous for God. They have their first love intact. They're excited about Jesus. They love Jesus. Everything they do, they're thinking about Jesus and whether this is pleasing to him, whether this is what he said. And then other things start to be distracting. Now, lots of normal things in life can get distracting. getting a job that takes a lot of your attention, having children and starting to care for a family. These are not so much distractions from Jesus per se. These are actually the way in which many people are called to serve Jesus. The service that Jesus calls many people to is to a normal job and to family rearing and things like that. It's not that kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm not really talking about activities as much as I'm talking about focus. A person can be very active in their job or in their family rearing and yet be focused on Christ. They keep their focus. They don't get distracted from Him. They're doing work, but they're doing it as unto the Lord, like Paul said to do for service. He says, when you serve your masters, do it as unto the Lord. So it's really the forefront of their mind is, what does Jesus want? How can I please Jesus? I'm all about Jesus, and this thing I'm doing is simply the thing He has me doing at the moment. And so I'll do it in a way that glorifies Him and pleases Him, because I take that as my assignment. Now, one could say Martha seemed to have that too as her attitude. The problem was, of course, she didn't have any idea whether that was her assignment or not. That was just her cultural role she was playing, and she wasn't really doing it with reference to anything she knew to be the will of Christ. But what I was talking about last time and this time I want to finish up is that people, in thinking that it'll make them a better Christian, become focused on side issues. Now, I think that this happens many times because some people get bored with Jesus and they just need to spice up their Christian life with something novel. And we live in a time where there's a lot of novelties for people to get distracted to in the Christian realm. And, you know, we talked about some of these last time. Many of you know people who have followed Christ as simple disciples and have moved into more formal, more liturgical, more ancient forms of worship. We talk about Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. Now, I want to say this. Many Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox people are focused on Jesus. Well, and I would say that probably more the case if people were raised in that form, and this is the way they always understood what it means to, you know, worship God. And maybe in their life they have always been or have become more in love with Jesus, but they're still doing so in the framework of these forms of worship that they grew up in. Now, on the other hand, there's many people who never were in those forms. They were evangelicals. They were converted. They were radical disciples of Jesus some years ago. Maybe they see themselves still as such. But they have found, you know, the walk with Jesus that they have always had needs something a little more to make them feel like they're really connected with God. And some of them move in the direction of going to these more liturgical kinds of churches. They feel there's more reverence there. They think there's more groundedness there in history. You know, unlike the evangelical churches that go to and fro after every wind of doctrine, these old ancient forms of worship claim to go back to the time of the apostles, and that they feel like they preserve the means of worship from the early church. The sad thing is you can't find any evidence, certainly in the Bible, much less in the earliest church fathers, that those are the forms of worship that were used in the early church. There's some reason to believe these are the way that the Christian church evolved over the first several centuries. So that indeed these Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, they're very ancient. And they do represent many of the venerable people in the later early centuries of the church who worshiped God in that way. And to this day, many godly people still worship God in those forms. However, if one has been a Christian following Christ without those forms, there would seemingly need to be some motivation for transitioning into them. And most people I know, it is my judgment, I'm not the final judge, so I may be wrong, but it's my impression that they were just starting to look for something to make their walk with Jesus a little more, give more pizzazz to their Christian life. And maybe they haven't been very reverent for the last few years. They may have been Christians for many years, and they've grown lukewarm, and then they meet someone who's excited about going to these churches and doing these things, the candles, the incense, the formality, and they say, well, I think I feel something religious here that I didn't feel before. And they move that direction in order, I believe in their minds, to get closer to Jesus. But many of the people that have done so, and this is not true only of people going to those movements, but Christians who go to any Christian movement, many times, if it's very different from where they were before, it becomes a focus for them. Every time they talk to other Christians, they want to talk about the things of that movement, the beliefs, the rituals of that movement. And I don't say this is true of everybody in those movements. I'm saying I've known too many people who that appears to be the case with. And my impression is they've been distracted from the simple walk with Jesus. Paul said he was fearful in 2 Corinthians 11 that as the serpent beguiled Eve, so the church's minds would be distracted from the simplicity that is in Christ. And you get all this complexity, and it feels like you're really doing a lot of things, worshiping more, more hands-on, more labor-intensive. Somehow it's probably better, I think. And so that's one way that you can get distracted from Jesus without leaving Christianity. We're not talking about backsliding here. We're not talking about moving into sinful lifestyles. We're talking about just kind of adding something or veering off a little bit into something that seems to promise to be a better way of following Jesus, or at least of worshiping. And yet it can, in a sense, eclipse Jesus in the minds of those who make those things important. This is also true of things that are not in those ancient forms, but evangelical forms. I talked about the word of faith teaching. That in evangelical churches, mostly Pentecostal type churches, the hyper grace movement, which is not in Pentecostal churches, but is in many evangelical churches, the idea that it's almost an antinomian idea that if you understand grace properly, you realize that you don't have to behave because grace is so great. The New Apostolic Reformation we made reference to, which is the Bethel movement and its affiliates. This, of course, is an intense focus on signs and wonders and the supernatural, which goes beyond even that of most Pentecostals. I mean, Pentecostals typically are believers in the supernatural. Charismatics are. I'm charismatic, technically. I certainly believe in the supernatural and the gifts, but the Bethel movement we're talking about typically makes that kind of their focus. And so when you're focused on power rather than on submission and humility, I'm not saying that the people in that movement are none of them humble or submitted to Christ. I'm saying it's such a, it adds something different that's always in the forefront of the mind that it can distract from the simplicity of just loving Jesus and saying, I wonder what Jesus wants me to do today. And I don't have to assume that it's going to be raising the dead or healing the sick that day or any given day. Jesus may not have that in mind. I want to listen to him rather than just assume that I know that this is the kind of thing Christians should be doing all the time. Then I talked about the Jewish roots movement. And that takes a number of forms. But the Jewish roots can be the Sabbatarian movement, or keeping the Sabbath. Again, I'm not against Christians keeping Sabbath. I think it's totally unnecessary. It's not commanded in the New Testament. I don't think Jesus ever instructed his disciples to keep the Sabbath. But there's Christians who think, well, it's in the Ten Commandments. You know, they did it from ancient times. So, you know, I think they don't really understand, I think, the difference between Old and New Testament. That's very commonplace for Christians to kind of be confused. How does the Old Covenant and the New Covenant work together? And for those who have never really worked that out, it just seems to them that the Ten Commandments are part of the New Covenant, too. And that would include the Sabbath. That's fine if someone makes that mistake and they worship God that way. But again, there are people who that's what they want to talk about on them. Hey, you're not keeping the Sabbath? You need to keep the Sabbath. And that becomes their hobby horse instead of Christ. Torah observance in general, not just Sabbath keeping, but some go so far as to want to have messianic synagogues and blow the shofar in the service because it's a very annoying sound. That I guess makes them feel like no one would endure that unless it was really a spiritual thing to do. You know, wearing yarmulkes and tzitzits and parading the Torah scrolls across the front of the synagogue, as they call it, which is really a group of Christians pretending to be Jews, and apparently not realizing that none of the things they're doing are found in the law at all. Those are all rabbinic customs that came in long after the temple was gone. And Moses never commanded any of those things. Yarmulkes, it's parading the scrolls, the Jewish style dances, those things are not Torah observant. They're like rabbinic Judaism later observance. But it's quite enamoring to people who are drawn to that kind of thing. Instead of say, they might not be drawn to Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy, but this is kind of a similar thing, a liturgy, a formality, a different kind of worship that they trace to the Old Testament. And therefore, they often have an Old Testament kind of religion rather than the fall of Christ. And Paul said, of course, in Galatians, that if you are, seeking to go back and be justified by the law, you've fallen from grace. You're alienated from Christ, he said. He said, if you get circumcised, you're obligated to keep the whole law, and Christ will profit you nothing, he said. So obviously, Paul saw that Torah observance is not something you add to your Christian walk to enhance it. If anything, Paul felt the Galatians had been distracted from Christ and even alienated from Christ by doing that very thing. I mentioned there's Anglo-Israelism, that is the belief that the English, the British Isles are where the 10 tribes went, and so those of us of Anglo background are Israel. On the opposite end of the spectrum, there's the Black Israelites, Black Hebrew Israelites. They believe the African races are the ones that are the true Israelites. As I said last time, neither of these is true, but even if they were, who cares? It sounds like the whole fascination with that is racist. I'm an Israelite. So how is that important unless racism is important? Is important what race you are? I don't think so. At least the Bible would argue it's not. So these are distractions. People get excited because they'll get the books and the websites and so forth for these things. And it's all new to them. And they say, well, that sounds right. That sounds good. And they just basically, maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, forget about Jesus and get into this weird stuff. The sacred names movement I mentioned also, people who think that you have to use the names in the Bible, God's name, Jesus' name, even the disciples' names. There's a guy named David Stern who has put out lots of books in the Torah Roots movement, and he even put out the complete Jewish Bible, which he translated, and he has his notes in, which I have upstairs, and I've read some of them. Interestingly, he, instead of using the forms of the names of Jesus and the disciples that are found actually in the Bible, he changes them all into the Hebrew forms. Now, notably, in the New Testament, which was written in Greek, none of the names in the Greek New Testament are in the Hebrew forms. They say, well, you need to say Yeshua, not Jesus or Jesus, because Yeshua is the Hebrew form. Well, indeed, it might very well be the Hebrew form. The New Testament writers, who were the apostles, didn't apparently think it was necessary to use the Hebrew form, because they always used the Greek form Jesus. They never used the term Yeshua in the New Testament. And they said, well, you have to call God Yehoshua, or that'd be Jesus, another form of Jesus, or Yahweh, or some form of it. That is the Hebrew form of the name of God. But that term is never found in the New Testament, not in the Greek. Peter, Paul, James, John, Matthew. And Matthew even wrote for Hebrews, for Jewish people, but never used the Hebrew forms of the name. It's a trip. It's kind of a little fad, and some people get carried away with it. There's people who are attracted to fads. They like variety. And some people jump from one of these to the next, to the next, to the next, just because I have to assume they're bored with Jesus. See, I don't understand how anyone can be bored with Jesus if they know him. If you know Jesus, he's like the most unboring person you could know. Many people may not like Trump, but Trump would not be a very boring person to know. He's a powerful person. You never know what he's going to do next. I'm not saying he's like Jesus. He's very unlike Jesus. But the point is that if you knew Trump, you might not like him, but you probably wouldn't get bored knowing him. And a thousand times more than that, infinitely more than that, Jesus is powerful, interesting, fascinating, deep, full of surprises. Jesus, you wouldn't get bored. If you know Jesus, you won't get bored of Jesus. Now, if you know about Jesus, if you're good at theology, but never connected with Jesus, and you're sort of like just another person you've read about, well, then, yeah, I suppose once you've read everything there is to read about him, you can get tired and start looking for something else to read or something else to get into. But if you actually are connected with Christ and following him and know him, you don't get bored of him. I've often told that when I first came into Calvary Chapel, when I was 16, out of a Baptist background. My Baptist background was pretty good. Evangelical, certainly orthodox in terms of major doctrine and so forth. And my doctrines were good. And I had evangelized others. I was leading people to Christ or trying to, as a Baptist before the Jesus movement. When I started going to Calvary Chapel, the first guy I met, a hippie in the back, just said, "Hey, brother, do you know the Lord?" I said, "Yes," because "know the Lord" was a phrase that meant, "Are you a Christian?" And I was assured as could be, I was a Christian. I think I was. But then he said, "Well, what's the Lord been doing in your life?" And suddenly he was speaking a foreign language. I did not have a relationship with God in which I was aware of anything being done in my life by God. I've told this story many times. It's so stark to me, the difference between knowing about God and knowing God. This guy had a walk with God. He was seeing God working in his life. He had come to know God from being a pagan, and it was like night and day for him. I was raised in the faith. I always believed in Christ, never had any doubts about Christ. I knew about him. I could tell you everything about him, probably. But I realized that this guy knew him in a different way than I did. He actually was interactive with Jesus on a regular basis and had his life changed, and Christ's spirit in him had revealed Christ within him, which the Bible talks about as normative, which I don't think had happened with me. And that was something I hungered for. I want that. I want Jesus. Give me Jesus. You can have all this other stuff. Just give me Jesus. Now, we went then to the whole idea of end times obsessions. This is where we kind of had to leave off last time. We ran out of time, but I don't need to tell you about what it looks like for people to have obsessions about the end times. They can be obsessed with just getting their eschatology right. What is the order of these things? People often ask me, "Okay, could you tell me what the right order is of all these things in the end times?" I think, well, as near as I can tell from the Bible, there's going to be a last day. There will be a resurrection, a rapture, a judgment, new heavens, new earth, all in the same day. I don't know exactly what order they all happen in, but they all happen in a day, the Bible says, on the last day, it says. So, but they want to know all the order of the tribulation events and so forth. Of course, I have a different view about the tribulation and its timing, but the point is that why would you want to know? Especially since most of these people don't even believe they'll be here for that. Most of them think there'll be a rapture at the beginning, but they are fascinated. Well, then when's the Antichrist rise? What nations are going to be coming down when and so forth? And what's going to happen to these people? And where are they going to go? I don't know. And more than do I not know, I don't even know that any of that stuff's going to happen. I don't find it in the Bible, but people read it between the lines mostly. But even if it's happening, why would it benefit me to know? When Jesus said, "Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" He said, "It's not for you to know times and seasons that the Father has put in his heart. This is not yours to know." And yet there are many Christians who, as soon as they start thinking they're in the end times, and they start hearing some Bible teacher who doesn't know anything about the Bible except his own eschatology and teaches it all the time, they begin to get obsessed with this. Like, this is a very important thing to know. And if they find out that you don't agree with them, they think you're a heretic. Just because you don't, of the 8 million scenarios about the end times, you don't hold the same one they hold. But they're just into it. It's definitely distracting from Jesus, totally. They might say, "Well, we're thinking about the second coming of Jesus." No, they're not talking about the second coming of Jesus very often. They mention it's one of the items in the scheme. It's like it comes at this point between this thing and this other thing, Jesus comes. No, they're thinking about Israel. They're thinking about Antichrist. They're thinking about everything, a new world order. They're watching out for the mark of the beast. They're not thinking about Jesus. They're thinking about something else. And the sad thing is, I personally think all the things they're thinking about that are poorly informed. Maybe it's because they've studied nothing in the Bible except their view through the eyes of their teachers, and they don't have enough broad knowledge of the Bible to know that, you know, there's not much support for any of that stuff you're saying. But nonetheless, I don't care if people have a wrong eschatology. I believe there's many people in many churches, many pastors in this town probably have a different eschatology than I do. Fine, if it doesn't distract them from Jesus. But I definitely know people who are distracted from just loving Jesus, following Jesus, fellowshipping with all those who are in the name of Christ with them, being one body with them in Christ. That's not what they're about. They're about their scheme. Of course, the modern state of Israel at this present time and at some other times in the past, certainly 1948 when it became a nation again, the early 70s when Hal Lindsey wrote The Great Planet Earth, and then more recently when the war between Hamas and Israel broke out, different punk, you know, our lifetimes and a little earlier than our lifetimes have been punctured by various seasons where Israel kind of comes up front and center. Everybody's thinking about Israel. I'm not, because again, this has to do with their eschatological scheme. They think that Israel and what happens there is pretty important. It may be important in some sense, but it's not important in terms of my Christian doctrines or my Christian outlook on things. I'm sure it's important to people who live in the Middle East and maybe some who are impacted by that, but so is the Ukraine-Russian war, and so are some other wars going on that people are not paying anywhere near as much attention to because Israel is so, they're obsessed with it. And all things Israel, you know, are fascinating to them. That's a distraction. Some people are fascinated by the fact that there's, you know, some group in Jerusalem wants to build the temple again, the Temple Institute. And somebody is actually breeding red heifers so they can burn them to ashes to put them in the holy water to sprinkle the new temple stuff. Who cares? I don't even believe there's necessarily going to be a new temple, but if there is, it has nothing to do with Christianity. The Jewish temple is against Christianity. There's no reason for the Jews to build a temple unless they're thumbing their nose at Jesus and saying, "You're not our final sacrifice. We're going back to the animals. We don't like you." I mean, certainly the Jewish religion has always thumbed its nose at Jesus Christ, ever since 70 AD, and frankly, even after 30 AD. And, you know, if they build the temple again, to my mind, it's no different than building a mosque. Why should we be interested in that? Some people are. People like to date set. They like to identify the Antichrist. And then connected with this, they like to get into certain conspiracy theories about the Illuminati and so forth. You know, there's this, some anti-Jewish people, of course, think of the grand conspiracy that's ruling the world is a bunch of powerful Jews. This is kind of easy to see why they think that, because so many powerful people are Jews, influential people. Hollywood is run by Jews to a very large extent, not entirely. Certainly the banking and financial interests of the world are very much overrepresented by Jewish people. I'm not saying that is a criticism of the Jews. Good for them. But to say that these people are running the whole world and all the governments bow to them and so forth, I know. I mean, anyone who's into that can give me all the paperwork and so forth. But then again, there's another group that says the Jesuits are running the whole world and they can give me all the paperwork proving it too. And then there's, you know, others who believe the communists are running the whole world, and they've got all the paperwork. Of course, some of these overlap, but the point is people are getting into these ideas. This is the end of the world. The Antichrist is going to come up through this conspiratorial group, and boy, we better keep our finger on the pulse. I remember the first time I heard about the Illuminati was back in 1978. I was running a Bible school in Santa Cruz, California. A guy came who had all kinds of information about the Illuminati. Fascinating talks. Everyone in politics at that point and Jimmy Carter was president, as I recall, or was running for president at that time. He said, yeah, the Illuminati has selected Jimmy Carter to be the Antichrist and named all kinds of people in Hollywood and in Washington, D.C. who are at these satanic witch meetings and stuff like that who are planning all this stuff. I thought, wow, this guy has names, dates, he's got all the receipts, so this must be true. And it kind of made me look at the world a different way for some time until I thought, well, yeah, but what can I do about it? Nothing. So I'll leave that for God to worry about. So that's what Isaiah said. He says, God said to me, don't worry about conspiracies. It's in Isaiah chapter 8. He says, the Lord spoke to me about these conspiracies. There were conspiracies in Isaiah's day. And many, there's been hundreds of conspiracies over the years. So what? God said, let the Lord be your fear. Let him be your dread. Don't worry about conspiracies. Why? For one thing, you can't change them. If they are true, you can't do anything about them. Now, somebody said, well, that's just the problem. People like you, you know, you're apathetic. You don't want to do anything about it. Well, if you think this is a fulfillment of prophecy, I can't change the prophecies. I don't believe it is a fulfillment of prophecy. I'm not even sure that the conspiracies that they're talking about, that they've got it right. The point is, I do not find anything in the Bible that makes it my duty to go out and stop the most powerful people in the world from doing what they do in dark places and smoke-filled rooms, you know, behind closed doors that nobody is allowed to know about. Well, they haven't invited me in, so I'll follow Jesus. I'm not going to be distracted by this kind of stuff, but I know many people who do. Now, I want to say this. Full preterism is another distraction that lots of people get into. Now, full preterism, of course, is the view that all things that were prophesied in Scripture were fulfilled in the first century, particularly in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed. Many years ago, about 40 or more years ago, I became a partial preterist, which means I began to recognize that there are many things in the prophets and in Jesus' teachings that I had been told and taught that they were about the end of the world. But as I read them in context, they're not talking about the end of the world. They're talking about what happened in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed and the new covenant replaced the old covenant. Many of them were that way. And I remember thinking, well, if that's true of some of them, maybe that's true of all of them. But I didn't entertain that for more than a day because I could think of too many passages that it wouldn't work with. And I still can. As some of you know, I've written a book against full preterism. I'm still a partial preterist. One of the incisive books about full preterism that came in the late 19th century was J. Stuart Russell's book, Parousian. Someone gave me that, and he applied virtually everything to 70 AD. And he was good. That's a good book, a very good book. I will tell you this. He went through all the stuff in the New Testament, and he was right. I saw it as he was right about 50% of the time. The other 50% I withheld judgment. I wasn't sure. He might be right about that too. I'll have to think about that. But I could see right away that about half the stuff he was applying to AD 70 in the context, clearly it was. Clearly it was about that, but no one had told me before. The other half of the stuff, some of it could be, but some of it certainly was not. And even he had to hold one exception. He believed that the resurrection at the end of the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 could not possibly be equal to 70 AD. And for a guy who equated everything else in the whole Bible with 70 AD, that was quite, obviously that passage caused quite a challenge. Full preterists usually include that resurrection too. I believe they do so by twisting and turning and reshaping things. I still am a partial preterist, but full preterism has moved forward and become a very popular, mostly internet phenomenon and their books by the guys on the internet. And many people are being persuaded of it. I've actually had people tell me that they became full preterists due to my influence years ago because I introduced them to partial preterism. And they didn't know where to get off that slippery slope. And as they all went all the way down into heresy. And what, by heresy, I don't know that if somebody is persuaded, well, yeah, if somebody thinks that there's no second coming because everything was fulfilled in 70, that's technically heresy. I mean, because it's against everything all churches of all denominations have ever taught until, frankly, the 20th century. And so it's a brand new doctrine. No Christian ever held it. Partial preterism, a different story. Full preterism, it's a heresy. Now, I'm not saying a person who holds a heresy can't be saved. Heresy is like a church council's kind of a meeting word. And if someone's a heretic, the church council, you're not saved. A heresy to me is something that simply deviates from all the beliefs of the church throughout history. And I don't know if you can go to heaven with it or not. I'm not damning these people. I'm saying it becomes an obsessive distraction for many. and it goes into weirder places, because once you've allowed yourself to disattach yourself from a belief that every Christian in history held until 1973 or something, you know, when Max King came up with the modern system. If everything all Christians believe was 100% wrong on this subject, and you're part of that little group since the last 55 years that knows this, that's first of all cultic. Secondly, it means that you've now adopted an attitude that I don't care if anyone ever saw it this way before. I'm going to see it this way. Now, I will say there are times when I'm reading the Bible, I see something differently than I have seen it taught anywhere else before. As soon as I begin to wonder, I'm probably wrong. I figure I'm probably wrong because I'm not so arrogant as to think of all the 100 million Christians or more that have lived, certainly more than that. I'm the guy. I'm the guy who sees that everyone else was just dull. I don't allow myself to think that ridiculous way. These people do. And then, since they're disattached from historic Christianity, why not move further and further away from historic Christianity? Some of the varieties of full preterism that have all arrived with the beginning of full preterism in the 1970s, it branches out into all kinds of heretical things. And the people who get into them, it's so minority that becomes their issue in many cases. They have to talk about this. They have to convince people of it. After all, if there's only you and three other people on the planet who believe something is true, you want some company. So you want everybody to see how foolish they have been. But I wrote down some of the varieties of full preterism that I'm acquainted with, that I've encountered. The Satan's Little Season and Hidden History Doctrine. This one I've run into a few places in recent months. Had never heard of it until maybe a year ago. This is a view that it's a conspiracy theory. Jesus actually returned in 70 AD. He reigned in a millennial reign on earth for 1,000 years. And so about 1,000 years ago, it ended. A millennium, he actually reigned a global peaceful kingdom for 1,000 years. You might say, wait. As I study history, the years from 30 AD or 70 AD to 1,000 AD weren't exactly characterized by global peace and righteousness and stuff. I mean, that doesn't sound very millennial. They say, yeah, the problem is they've expunged all the history and rewritten it so you won't know. In other words, there's this hidden history. They think that some archaeological finds and stuff like that are kind of out of step with the standard history, and they think, oh, this fits better, this idea that, things were different than we were told. And so they believe that there was actually a millennial reign of righteousness and peace with Christ on earth for 1,000 years from 70 AD until about 1,000 years ago. Now, somehow, even though in the Bible the 1,000-year reign ends with Satan's attempts to overthrow it, but Satan is overthrown instead, which would presumably mean the reign of peace continues because the opposition has been overthrown. They say, no, things have changed now back to the bad way, and only a few people, like 4 or 5 people, know. I'm saying 4 or 5, it's good. There probably might be 40 of them or 50 of them, maybe more. But the point is, they're the only ones who know that the history is not what we've been taught. That there literally was a 1,000-year reign of peace on earth when Jesus returned in 70 AD, and now it's been obscured. It's a hidden history. Who hid it and why, I'm not really sure. But since it's, I can't let myself believe such stuff. I don't have to worry about why it would be true, since there's no reason to believe that it is. Now they say, you haven't looked into it. They found these archaeological things that are different than what we've been told. Yeah, that kind of thing has happened throughout the whole history of archaeology. People have to change their minds about a lot of things. But to say that the entire history of the world was rewritten by, like the writings of Herodotus and Thucydides, of course, they're pre-Christian. But you get into the early, like Josephus and other, Roman writers and so forth, and say, well, all their works, they've gone back and they've rewritten them and taken out all the stuff. They've written total fabricated histories to replace the real. Well, that sounds very labor-intensive. It must be a very good reason for doing that. and they somehow managed to get all the manuscripts of the originals disappeared. And to me, a person can believe that if they want to. I will have very little respect for their rationality if they do, but I won't say they can't be saved and be that mistaken. I will say, though, they're distracted. They're distracted from Jesus. Jesus never taught any of those things. Following Jesus doesn't require that we know any such things. Knowing mysterious things that no one else knows is kind of one of these things that they characterize people who get distracted from Jesus. There's also the full preterism has led some people into antinomianism because, hey, the law ended in 70 AD. There's no laws of any kind now. They don't seem to know anything about the law of Christ, apparently. But therefore, we can live any way we want to because we're not under any law at all. Well, we're not under the Jewish law. We are under the law of Christ, Paul said. So, but let's face it, people who get into these are not really balanced Bible scholars. I mean, there's not people who have labored for years to master every part of the Bible so they can see it holistically. They've got some verses here, verses there, verses here, and they say, someone told me it puts together this way, and I like it that way. Well, that's not, I don't know, I can't respect that kind of an attitude because it's not focused on Jesus, frankly. It's focused on esoteric things that nobody can know except the people in the group. There's also, among full preterists, the corporate immortality view, which sees that no one is individually immortal, only the church collectively is immortal. There will always be the living body of Christ, but no human beings will be immortal in it. You know, we spend our little time in it and then go the way of, I guess, disappearance, extinction. There's also the no-devil preterism. This teaches that Satan was entirely symbolic of the Old Testament Jewish religion. And since that's gone, Satan no longer exists either. That is one of the things that most full preterists do believe, that Satan was put into the lake of fire in AD 70 and doesn't exist anymore. Why people are still demon-possessed? Well, they deny that. They would say demon possession, it doesn't exist anymore. Although I know for a fact that it does. I've been in his presence on many occasions. And certainly foreign missionaries would never fall for that one. Missionaries in India and China and Africa, they're never going to be convinced that they're still demon possession because they know. It's an academic point held by people who have the apparently an ivory tower understanding of reality that they don't get out much. They think there's no devil or demons. Now, you know, again, I don't see how a person can follow Jesus at all with those particular beliefs. But many of these people, they're kind of innocently wandering into this stuff out of a concern to just know the Bible better and understand these things better. And I'm pretty sure that people can become so distracted by these things that they forget Jesus altogether, or at least disagree with him. Okay, a few more things, we're done. Obviously, people can be distracted from Jesus by worldly loyalties, political loyalties, denominational loyalties, sports teams. Now, I'll tell you what, I don't know anyone who worships sports teams, but I'm not in that crowd that even cares about sports. I do see people who act like they worship sports teams. They wear their jerseys, they paint their faces, they scream and jump around and turn cars over if something happens to their sports team that they don't want. Sounds like they're willing to commit any kind of crime, change anything about themselves, cause their whole emotional world to revolve around sports teams. Now, I'm not against sports. I've never been against sports. Never had much interest in it. And the reason is that I've always seen sports. I mean, it's a diversion. It's not a sin to have a bit of a diversion. I mean, if you don't, like, I'd rather read a book. I would even watch something on television before I'd go to sports. But, I mean, that's a diversion, too. I'm not saying we have to be thinking about spiritual things every moment, focus, only on, reading the Bible, although that's the most exciting thing I can imagine. But there are times where you seek certain diversions, even if it's just going out with friends and talking with them about things. But I'm not talking about people who have sports as a diversion. My dad, he kind of likes sports. Like, once in a while, he'd sit and watch a baseball game or a football game. Sometimes I'd sit and watch a little bit. Didn't hold my interest, I'd leave. But he didn't care who won or lost. was just something to distract him, I guess, briefly. But it didn't become something that distracted him from his walk with Jesus or from his focus on Jesus. But some people do. And people are that way about their political parties, too. Now, politics is a little bit of a different thing, but it can still be an issue. Politics has become more about morality than about politics. Politics means the way you govern. And it used to be that if you're a Democrat or Republican, the way you govern would be relatively similar to the other party. You still didn't want people murdering babies, for example. You didn't want people to cut off the genitals of little boys and let men go into women's locker rooms. I mean, the political parties have diverged on issues of sanity and morality in a way that they used to not. It used to be that both political parties were pretty much American, quasi-Christian in their morality, and they had some different ideas about how much taxation there should be, how big the government should be, and so forth. And those were the political differences. Now, I believe even the issue of how big the government is a moral issue, but it's not so obviously one. A person who is a morally just Christian could mistakenly get the wrong idea about how big the government should be. So I'm not making that a test of faith. Now, I would say this, the modern Democrat Party, if it doesn't overthrow its more radical wing, is going to have nothing that Christians can support in it before long. In fact, that may be the next election. Suddenly, the Democratic Party, which has been going left for a long time, has gone over the cliff. And I'm not sure how any Christians can support it. I make that not as a political statement. I make that as a Christian statement about, you know, you as a Christian, you support God's morality. And if you're part of a Democratic Party that doesn't reject morality, but they just want to have, you know, higher taxes on some particular thing, I don't fault you for that. But that's not what the Democrat Party is anymore, I'm afraid. They're going to have to find another party for the middle of the road people. I'm obviously more on the right, and then there are people who are not as much on the right as I am, but they're still good people, moral people, Christian people. They see policies differently. That's what the Democratic Party used to be. But now the Democratic Party has been taken over by evil, and even the Democrats who are not radicals are alarmed. They're alarmed in how are we going to get free from this crazy wing, you know? But the point is, because things become crazy, I mean, people who get on the crazy wing, they look at the right wing, they're the crazy ones. You look at law enforcement going on in a big city, and radicals who are paid by a communist get out there and force and interfere physically with the cops and things like that. This is something neither Democrats or Republicans would ever have supported before. But now it's like, you know, the Democratic Party is afraid to say anything against it. So those who think, well, law enforcement's a good thing. Well, we're the radicals on the right now. It's not really radical. It's just what everyone thought, you know, day before yesterday. But now, if you say, I think people who break the law should probably be subject to normal law enforcement. 99% of human beings have always believed that. Now you're on the far right if you do this. So I don't want to be far right or far left. I just know that the views that everybody held are now labeled those ways. The point is, though, because the disparity is so great, it's a war. I mean, if it's not a shooting war yet, it's at least a war of words, a war of ideas, alienating people. And as a Christian, if you take one of these positions, you almost feel like you have to be, you know, a fighter for that position. Now, there are people, no doubt, called to fight for political positions. There are people, I believe, who are called to run for government office and things like that. But to be distracted by these political things can make you forget altogether what the mission is of a Christian and take your eyes off Jesus. I know, because I'll watch news or listen to it, or there's some podcasts that are news related. And I get thinking about those things, saying, wow, this is, you know, this is really something. I try to, you know, acquaint myself with it, and I think, wait a minute, when I sit down and read a Christian book or read the Bible or listen to the Bible on my phone, I think, oh, this is so refreshing. It's so refreshing to get back to thinking just about Jesus. But some people have redefined their mission by politics or their denomination or their sports loyalties or whatever. It's just, you just have to be careful. I'm not saying that denominations and sports teams and political views, I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm saying they capture your imagination, they capture your affection, they capture your emotional energy, and suddenly you're not walking with Jesus the way you used to. Now, one other category, and we'll be done here, and that is miscellaneous quirky fads. Now, as far as I know, a person can be in any of these fads and be a good Christian. I think they're mistaken. I think these fads are kind of kooky, but obviously some people are way into them, and I think, well, there's worse things a person could be into. I'm not here to condemn them. I'm just saying there are people I know who get into these things, and then they want to talk about these things a lot. Why? Because it's interesting. It's sexy. It's novel. One of those things is King James only. Now, that's not new. It's only like a century old, though. And that's because the King James was the only Bible in English that most people were reading for the last, you know, 125 years or so. But that when modern translations started being made, people who had always read the King James felt like, well, this passage I know, it's not saying it the same way. I like the old way of saying it better. I'm one of those people. I've never been King James only. I'm not now, never was. I've always thought that's absurd when I first learned there were people who were. But when I first started NASB or some of the NIV, the Good News Bible back in the 60s and 70s, I remember thinking, I like it better the way it was in King James. That's the way I learned it. That's the way I quote it. That's the way I remember it. And I will say this. I did enough study to realize that some of the changes were well justified because we now had older manuscripts of the Greek than they had in the days of 1611 when they made the King James. There are some probably some better readings in some of these more lately discovered manuscripts. Scholars work on that. Some scholars work on it all the time. And they have put together an idea of how the manuscripts used by King James may have been changed from earlier, and they have some ideas from the earlier manuscripts. They found out what it may have read like earlier. Now, sometimes, therefore, a verse in a modern translation will not even say the same thing that it said in the King James. But that's very rare. What is more often the case is that modern translations don't they don't accommodate the King James language. And there are people who think that God spoke in King James. You know, it used to be a joke when new translations came out. People say, what do you think about it? People say, well, King James is good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me, you know. And it wasn't good enough for Paul. Paul didn't ever see a King James version of the Bible, and he would have not been able to read it if he'd seen it. And there's, you know, King James English is archaic. Now, if you understand that English, fine. I love it. I grew up bilingual. I could speak English and King James English. And I can read the King James. It's just like my native language. I grew up with it. And I don't have any problem with it. I have more trouble with Shakespeare than with King James. Shakespeare's a little harder to understand for me. But the thing is, okay, I love the King James. And I taught from the King James for the first 12 or more years of my ministry until I found out that another generation coming up younger than me, they said, we don't understand all that these and those stuff. So I thought, well, get over it. Grow up. Learn. Yeah. You know? And then I thought, well, you know, I don't want to dumb things down for them, but there's no mandate in the Bible that we have to use the 1611 English translation, when there's been probably 100 English translations of different kinds over the years, besides the King James that have come out. So I moved to the New King James because it was the closest to the way I was familiar with quoting things. Not because I know it to be the very best translation. I don't know what the very best translation is. A lot of the translations are pretty good, and I think most of them are fine. So, you know, while I like the King James only is just ignorance. It assumes that somehow the manuscripts used by King James were providentially preserved from being changed in any way from the first century until 1611. We now know that's not true because there's so many different manuscripts that aren't exactly the same. We can see that it wasn't preserved exactly the same. But it doesn't matter because the meanings are not significantly different. It doesn't matter what, you know, it doesn't matter if you use Old English, Modern English, different choices in Modern English. If you're getting the point across that was in the Greek and the Hebrew, that's okay. But some people just want to be, they say, listen, if you don't believe in King James only, you don't believe that there's one Bible that's inerrant. We believe the King James is inerrant, and all the others, if they're different, must not be inerrant. So you don't believe we have an inerrant Word of God that you can hold in your hand. I've had people say to me, you don't believe there's an inerrant Bible you can hold in your hand. Right, exactly. I mean, maybe the Greek might be inerrant, but I don't think any English translator is an inerrant human being. And the King James translators themselves didn't believe they were. They made it clear when they wrote the introduction to the King James, there could be better translations that come along after them. Others may do better than they did. But it's just, I guess it's sentimentality, it's a love of tradition, it's a love of the familiar that older generation had that made them object to the King James changing. Now, I would be happy as could be if the King James if we never had another English translation, frankly. I'm not saying it's the best. I'm just saying that most of the newer ones, they may improve some of the defects of the King James, but they make their own defects. There's human translators are human, and they make mistakes. The King James is certainly close enough to give me all the knowledge of God I would ever want, and I have no problem with the Old English. But I'm also not a person who says, and therefore we must keep it. I have found it inconvenient with many translations, but when I'm teaching, it'd be nice if everyone had the same translation as they did for hundreds of years in English. If I could quote without copyright concerns. The King James was never copyrighted, so you can quote it in the public domain. All the modern translations are copyrighted. If you quote very much of it in print, you have to get permission from them to do it because they own it, which is kind of objectionable to me. But having said all that, I'm sympathetic toward King James. I certainly would never be King James only. There's no arguments in its favor. In my opinion, no sensible ones. And yet some people are way into it because I think these people maybe worship the Bible, particularly the King James Bible, more than God. The King James Bible is a great tool for getting the words of God to us, the truth of God to us. But when you start worshiping the messenger and not the source, then you've gotten distracted. Now, there's the flat earth idea, of course, and there are people in our fellowship here who believe in the flat earth. I don't. I think it'll be a really hard thing to maintain once Elon Musk is transferring people regularly up to the space station where they can look back and see it. All the pictures of the round earth, they believe, are fake, and that everyone in the space program is part of a conspiracy to conceal that the earth is really flat, which, by the way, they do so because they believe the Bible teaches it. I don't think anyone came up with a flat earth idea without being concerned that this is what the Bible teaches. Because when I ask flat earth people why, they say, well, because the Bible talks that way. Well, the Bible uses a lot of poetry. There's no non-poetic verses in the Bible that teach there's a flat earth. And there are some things in the Bible that indicate others. I'm not here to debate that point. What I'm here to say is whether the earth is flat or not, it's irrelevant. And if there is a great conspiracy that, you know, all the scientists, all the governments, everyone who's been in space, all the people who've, you know, photographed this, and so forth, they're all involved to try to convince us the earth is a globe instead of flat, I have to say, why? Why would they do that? That takes an awful lot of energy to conceal something from billions of people on earth, any of whom might end up going into space themselves someday. It's a very hard thing to conceal things, especially when there's thousands of people in on the conspiracy. Usually one of them, you know, just for a hot take in the news, would spill the beans, you know. The truth is, I don't care if the earth is flat or round. It doesn't make a hill of beans difference to me. If someone believes it's flat, they think differently than I do about evidence and stuff. But I will say this, it's a very strange thing to think that the difference between a flat earth view and a global earth view is so important to somebody that, you know, the secular world has to conceal it from us. But now, I've asked why they would do that, and some of the flat earth people have told me, well, it's because they want people to disbelieve the Bible. Now, what they're suggesting is the Bible teaches a flat earth, but they want everyone to think the Bible is wrong by making people think the earth is a globe. Now, what's interesting about this, but it's not going to change the view about the Bible. Something when it didn't really happen. Now, the classic case when people would call me about the Mandela effect, they think it's true. They say the King James Bible has been changed, not by new translations, the old ones. The old version your grandmother had on her bookshelf, check it out. The text has magically changed from what it used to be. Because, don't you remember when you read the King James, when you were young, that it said the lion shall lay down with the lamb? No, it never said that. No, I know, it did, they say. No, it never said that. I read it when I was a kid. That's 70 years ago. I didn't read it 70 years ago. I'd be pretty young. But over 60 years ago, I read it. Long before the Mandela effect, whatever. My Bible, my King James, never said the lion shall lay down with the lamb. It says the wolf will lay down with the lamb or whatever. So different. There's a lion in there. I think it lays down with a kid or something. But the wording is different than they remembered it. Or than they thought they remembered it. And they say, look at that. Every King James Bible and every shelf has been magically changed. That's demons released into the world to confuse people. Well, you guys are the ones confusing people. They have a series of verses that they thought they remembered a certain way in the King James Version. And they look at the King James Version and say, wait, that's not the way I remembered it. So that's the Mandela effect. And they say, how could that have changed? It's been sitting on the bookshelf. It's been sitting in my grandma's attic for 70 years. And how did someone get in there and change the words? It's magic. It's demonic. And I say, come on. What a ridiculous thing. But it is ridiculous. Because frankly, I read the King James when I was young. I memorized a lot of it then. It hasn't changed. The King James I have myself right now has the same words as I memorized when I was young. But the funny thing is, I mean, this is how people don't think very clearly. Suppose demons have been unleashed in the world from some portal in Europe, and they have the power to change words in the King James Version of the Bible. First of all, why would they do it in the King James Version? Few people read that anymore. Why wouldn't they do it in the Bibles people are actually reading? Secondly, why would they change those words? If these are demons trying to deceive people, why wouldn't they change the teaching that Jesus is God or Jesus is the Messiah or any other important doctrine? Why? How are they going to deceive the whole world by changing the wolf shall lie down with the lamb to the wolf shall lie down with the kid? Or, if demons could change the words of the Bible mysteriously, wouldn't they change the ones that matter to them and to us? I mean, this is just such a, people are not thinking well, but I'm not here to complain about how poorly people think. What I'm here to complain about is how people get into that. I think this is important. We need to tell everyone about this. I'm going to read all the articles about this. I'm going to email people about this. That's a distraction. Like many other distractions from Jesus, it's a very common thing. People love to be distracted from Jesus about one thing or another. And Lord knows there's plenty of options. But you may be distracted by many things, but only one thing is needful. And that is that you are walking with Jesus like you did the day you met him. Now, you'll grow. You're not going to be a baby Christian or less. But growing doesn't mean you get distracted from Jesus. It doesn't mean you add on things that then become anchors that pull you out of the boat. It means you get a deeper understanding of Jesus. You learn to follow him more faithfully. You begin to look more like him in your life. Not you get distracted by every novel theory that comes along that claims to have some, reason to be looked at by Christians. If any of these things that I don't believe in that I mentioned are actually turn out to be true, it won't make a difference in the world to me. The things I'm refuting here or that I'm coming against are things I certainly don't think are true, but who cares? What if they are? Who cares? Well, some people care, and I have to think anyone who cares very much about those things, they just got the wrong set of priorities. And the right set of priorities is be obsessed with Jesus. He's the only thing worthy to be obsessed with. And many Christians were obsessed with Jesus in their early walk, but they left their first love, and now they love other things too, maybe more.